Good evening. Welcome to Tales of Valor and Sorcery. I'm Eric Jensen. This is the Anchorcast in which I talk about D&D role-playing games and other assorted stuff. It's been over a month since I published a podcast. That's because real life takes precedence. It's a thing that, at my age, I think is normal. You set priorities for the things in your life, and I don't feel ashamed that, you know, my kids and my wife and work come before my hobby stuff. I wouldn't even say that I regret it. There are days when I wish I had more time to do more hobby stuff. But I always find myself asking for an expansion of the day, not a reduction of my duties, if that makes any sense. So today we're going to talk about some odds and ends that I've recorded over the last couple weeks and slap them together into something resembling an episode. And then we'll move on. It's Thanksgiving weekend here in the United States as I record this intro. So happy Thanksgiving. It's the beginning of the holiday season. And hopefully you'll be able to get some gaming time in the winter months. But as far as I'm concerned, winter time is good for indoor projects. I'm hoping to be working on some terrain. So I might talk about that a little bit in some future episodes, but it's kind of hard to talk about the terrain you're building in an audio format and really get the point across. But we'll see. So anyway, episode 3. The announcement of the pending dissolution of G+ faces me with a quandary. For a number of years, I ran a blog, wampuscountry.blogspot.com, that, you know, contained my D&D ramblings and some session notes and some ideas and random tables we're sharing and all this kind of stuff. And that's out there on Blogspot. And although it has languished for a number of years and the comment sections of certain posts have become littered with, you know, bot spam and, you know, digital detritus, that stuff's all still there and it's not going anywhere. But when I look at the G+ stuff and I think, okay, well, this is only going to be around till next August at best, right? Because who knows what'll happen before then. I need to come up with a strategy for scraping this content. Now, I'm not talking about a tool to do it. I've seen some posts and I know that there are tools that we'll go through and to varying levels of satisfaction, extract my posts. That's really not my major concern. I don't mind doing it by hand. In fact, I think I probably ought to do it by hand as a reminder of what's there rather than just some kind of weird data dump that I might not look at. My question is how to go about it in a way that's useful. So I have a private G+ community for the Wampus Country campaign that had a bunch of members, a good amount of posts, mostly from me, right? Because it's for running the game. And that's got like 3 years worth of session summaries and all kinds of back and forth downtime posts and a couple play-by posts, side story things. So I want to keep all of that and arrange it in a document in a way that's useful to me. And then and the secondary way may be useful to others, right? So I need to figure out how I want to preserve all that stuff and then extract from that things that are useful for the campaign moving forward, which might be a lot of it, a lot of NPC names, all this kinds of stuff. And then parallel to that, because I knew that that community was private when I originally set it up, because it was meant for people who were just in the player pool, I know I have lots of content out there that's posted, not publicly, but to my RPG circles, that's more general gaming content, or is stuff that I might want to look at, reflect on, save. So I'm going to have to go through all that. So I'm a little daunted by the prospect of setting aside the hours, and it's going to have to be in multiple chunks, unless I break my leg or something, to go through this in a systematic way. And I look forward to being frustrated by G+'s inability to present them, all these posts to me, in the same order every time. But that's something that has to be done. I think, you know, preserving the record of that campaign, even if I were to never start it back up, is something worth doing so that I can look back on the things that happened there and maybe other people can look at it, take lessons from it. And also I can use it to, you know, sort of generate ideas for other campaigns or for articles or, you know, podcasty stuff. When you look back at a session that you forgot happened and think, oh, wow, that did happen. That was a weird one. Maybe I want to talk about that. I want the ability to do that easily. So I need to invest the time. I need to start over the holidays. It's the only time it's going to work. And take an hour a day or something and just start scraping by hand and pulling the stuff and dropping it into a document, probably reformatting it later. And that's going to be ugly. you know, because you're looking at a multi-page session report followed by, you know, 40 different player posts asking questions, or like we do a downtime interrogation of the person that got captured at the end of the session, that kind of stuff. It's going to be a little ugly, but I think it'll be worth doing. And then hopefully I'll be able to shape that up without too much heartache into a form that other people could read. Not just people that played in the campaign who might get, you know, some nostalgia bump from it or whatever, but people who didn't and can sort of follow along and see how this regular-irregular campaign worked with rotating PCs and all this kind of stuff. We have a lot of actual plays out there these days. They're not often presented in a form that can be used as a teaching tool, like as an object lesson. I think there is some value in going back over this stuff sometimes. Not with a fine-tooth comb, not with a legalistic Hosanna in the highest, let us see what the ancient masters did way, but just for me to say, hey, here's a thing I did, here's what I was thinking about when it happened, here's what I think about it now, and, you know, see who's interested in following along and maybe attempting to learn from some of my mistakes. So that's what's coming up for me, is the great scrape. Okay, let's try for another example of clever or dumb. This is the segment on the show in which we talk about a mechanical concept, or maybe we'll get to setting concepts eventually, and try to decide whether they're clever or dumb. Typically, it will be something I've never actually used, just some, maybe a dice mechanic or whatever that seemed elegant at the time and won't get out of my skull. Today's clever or dumb is a mechanic I call legendary kills, which sounds maybe more awesome than it is. So here's the concept. From an in-world perspective, you're dealing with a fantasy game in which the slaying of a legendary creature could impart to the weapon that does the slaying a magical quality, right? You stab a dragon in the heart, and all of a sudden your crappy sword is now magical, right? So any world in which this is possible, you could use this legendary kills concept. So here's the first part. Your chance of a legendary kill, and we're talking about the killing blow here, right? The chance of a legendary kill is based on level. This is because the eyes of the fates, or the gods, or whatever, are more likely to be upon a more impactful hero. It's also a subtle means of game balance, I guess. So, legendary kill, I stab the dragon in the heart. I have a percentage chance equal to my level of automatically imbuing that weapon with some magical quality. You could also do it where if I happen to do the killing blow and it's a critical, then maybe I have double my level, right? So if I'm 5th level, I have a 5% chance. 10th level, 10% chance. You follow along. Double that if it's a crit. So the next part is what happens? Does it become a magic plus 1 weapon? Is that it? Well, you could do it that way. That's a little less exciting. I tend to like dice mechanics that give you more than one axis of information. In this case, we can use our die roll to determine not only whether there was a spontaneous enchantment, but also what the spontaneous enchantment was. So you could gin up a table that goes from 1 to, I don't know, you could probably make it to 10, and that would get you by for a while, and have your different magical effects on that table for the enchantment, with the lesser-powered ones down at the low end, 1, 2, 3, higher-powered ones up towards the high end. And what this will do is, it means that when a lower-level character manages to score a spontaneous enchantment from a killing blow, that they're going to get a low-level appropriate or minor magical enhancement. A higher-level character, of course, at least has the option for a higher-level spontaneous enchantment. So you can do that and do it in sort of a generic way. I think the risk here is that if you use the mechanic and you start to like it, well, then you're going to want a thematically appropriate table, right? You're going to want one table for demons and one table for dragons and one for creatures of fire or whatever, because you're going to want that spontaneous enchantment to maybe make sense based on the thing that you killed. So that, in a nutshell, is the concept of legendary kills. Spontaneous enchantment of a mundane weapon due to the killing blow on a legendary creature. Now, what counts as a legendary creature in your campaign? There could maybe only be a couple on the map, right? The truly legendary creatures of the setting. or maybe any unicorn would be good, right? I think it's pretty satisfying narratively to even incorporate this stuff for the NPCs, right? If you've got some blackguard, some evil paladin who kills a unicorn with their hunting spear, and then, you know, they've got that hunting spear just dripping with unicorn blood. If that spear is now evil and enchanted, awesome. That makes sense to me. Especially if the creature is truly legendary, right? It's the last unicorn. I won't sing the song. When we think about this, we could do it in a lot of different ways. It doesn't even have to be a killing blow, right? If you do this as a special thing for the fighters, and it wouldn't have to be fighters only, although it could be, if you decide that it's a blessing that's given by the god of war or something, or the god of heroism and glory. But obviously your fighty types are maybe more likely to be scoring hits or critical hits, thus triggering the potential spontaneous enchantment. Your players are going to wonder, well, why can't other classes do this? Where? How else can we do this? And that brings up a much larger issue of, in a world full of magic, where things can become spontaneously enchanted, how do we do that, right? So maybe you could use similar rules to assign to other things. If you're a cleric, maybe you don't use the legendary kill rule. Maybe when you visit the sacred shrine on the top of the mountain that has the ancient spring of purest holy water, maybe if you leave your mace in there overnight on the night of the full moon, maybe you have a percentage chance by level or something else that it becomes spontaneously enchanted or temporarily enchanted or however else you'd want to do it. You can come up with the stuff for any class and give them things to do. Let's remind ourselves that, you know, whether you want to use a side rule like this or not, the players need toys, not just their PCs. They need things in the campaign with which to interact. They need some that are sprung upon them, so they have to make difficult, spontaneous decisions with lower information. And they need some that are a ways out in time or in distance, so they can make the decision based on what I know about this thing, the mountain shrine, the legendary dragon, whatever. I want to invest the time to go there and do this thing. That is what will help shape your campaign and keep it moving forward in a direction defined by the players rather than defined by the author of an adventure. You'll be able to string the stuff together. Now, when you implement a house rule like this that's based on the intrinsic magical metaphysics of your setting, you're going to have to decide whether your PCs know that this is a thing that can happen or not, right? You thrust your spear into the heart of the dragon, it becomes enchanted. I mean, is this a rumor thing? Is this a thing wizards can vouch or is true? All that. So you have to think about those knock-on effects when you're actually establishing the setting that spins out of a rules choice. Okay, so that's legendary kills. Let me know what you think about it in call-ins or via email or Twitter, and we'll decide as a group whether that rule is clever or dumb. When you're blogging about D&D stuff and putting content out there, it can be difficult to really have a grasp of whether people are using your stuff. It's easy to get occasional feedback, hey, great post, that kind of stuff, or I love that table. It was always harder for me when I was blogging regularly to get the sort of feedback that made me feel compelled to keep posting. Now, obviously, if I need outside input to make me blog, then maybe I'm not destined to be a blogger, and I've finally sort of come to grips with that. But when I was doing it, obviously you want some feedback that is substantive, right? Not just praise that, hey, good post, whatever. But you want to see a level of engagement that suggests that if you're putting out shareable content that you think is the sort of thing other people might use, right? Random tables, methodologies, that kind of stuff. Not just stuff about your game and the setting, right? Then at some point, you expect to hear back, hey, I used your table in my session last night. It was crazy. Here's what happened. That's not the sort of feedback I often got. Occasionally, I'd have somebody say, hey, this is a cool table, I'm going to put it in my DM notebook, right? Which is a huge compliment, right? To hear that somebody thinks that content you created is of sufficient value, and not just like inspirational value, but maybe on-the-spot usage value, that they're going to print it out or customize it and print it out and then throw it in their DM binder for their next game. So that, you know, maybe next session or a year from now, something wacky comes up, and then, some essential stranger is using your potion table in their game. That's cool. That's a great feeling. It's a great thing to look forward to. But in my experience, when I was blogging at Wampus Country, I didn't get that all that often. And that's kind of why I stopped doing the massive random tables I was doing for a while. For a while there, I was getting some enjoyment for myself out of doing these big D100 multi-column random tables. Like, I had a template, I would set it up and then have an idea for something, and I would put down 100 rows and a couple columns of, you know, sword enchantments or wizard, like, names and familiars and their area of study and their hobby or whatever. The sort of thing that was themed together, and then you could use each column as a separate table or roll them together, whatever you want to do. So I did a number of these for a couple years. Every couple months, I'd crank one out. And sometimes I'd be working on one in the background and not say anything, and it would take a while to really fill in all the holes with something that I felt was meaningful, useful, the sorts of entries that might spur adventure hooks rather than just be filler. And I would put these out, and people would say, "Whoa, that's crazy, blah, blah, blah." And I was super excited because I thought I was being pretty innovative. Not innovative. I thought I was doing things as a content provider, I hate that phrase, as a creator that I thought the audience would want, right? And I was producing it in a format that I, the audience, would want. For example, I would do these tables, and rather than format them in a finished PDF, which was kind of beyond me at the time anyway, or post them up on the blog to be read on the web, I was doing them as a Google Doc, right? So that people could go to the Google Doc, save off a copy locally, and then make their own changes and customize the table, right? It isn't that there were holes in the table, but, like, they could have their own one and customize it. Or if they used an entry, they could then replace it, right? And that would be specific to their table or their campaign. That's the way I would have used it, were I the audience. I think part of the problem was that I'm not my own audience. I mean, I am. I create things for my own enjoyment, for my own usage. But it's possible that what people were looking for was tables they could use on the fly on the web, right? We saw this surge a couple times of people trying to automate things and put them in Abulafia or whatever, different websites, so that you could just click a button. Say, "I need a potion," click the potion button. And some of my tables did end up there, thanks to Mr. Mullins, who invested a lot of time in translating some of those. Thank you, Brian. But I think the idea that, hey, here's a thing that I want you to customize and download and maybe print out, well, that's showing my age, or it's showing the way that I run a game. At the time, even though I was running some games online, and, you know, you'd have multiple tabs open and all this kind of stuff, at the time when I was writing those tables, I was still relying on printed material for at least 50% of my prep, or my my sort of improv cue tools, right? So my tool bag, as it were, was dumped out on the table in front of me, on the desk, not existing in the cloud. Would I do that differently today? Yeah, I have. I mean, I've run games with just a bunch of tabs open, right, and no notes or anything. I certainly don't have a DM binder the way I did back in the 90s. I abandoned that a long time ago. So I think as I go through and figure out what to do with these tables, and they're still perfectly viable, they're just maybe not in a format that everybody would love, how best to re-present them. You know, if they're all on the blog, there's a heading, random tables, anybody can get to them, but I'm not sure that that's the way people look for stuff. Right? It's buried on the blog. Even if it's all on one page, it's buried on somebody's blog. Would I be better off taking those tables and figuring out how to put them in a proper, you know, multi-page table format in a PDF and putting that up on DriveThru or whatever? Yeah, I probably would. The question is it worth the investment in time or in money if I had somebody else do the layout? Because if we want it to look decent, somebody else is going to do the layout. So that's kind of where I am on that. It's potentially a pretty huge project. My guess is that formatting multi-column, multi-row, multi-page random tables in InDesign is probably not something anybody wants to do for fun. If I'm wrong about that, email me. But anyway, the tables are out there. And it's just got me thinking about the way we present content in a digestible form. And I guess part of the reason I'm thinking about that is, you know, sharing things via Anchor or via podcast as compared to via blog. There are plenty of things that I had posted on the blog that some people saw back then. There are plenty more people who could see them again now, except the blog doesn't really get traffic, and I'm not aiming for that. But what's the best way for me to take something from the blog that I think is generally useful and present it, you know, via Anchor, let's say? So I'll be putting some thought into that, and, you know, maybe have some recycling-type segments here on Anchor where I take something from the blog that is suitable for an audio delivery and, you know, talk about it that way. We'll see. I know I have some Christmas-related stuff buried on the blog that might be worth throwing into the next episode or two. I feel compelled to talk about Session Zero. It seems like every couple weeks or months I read a blog post or an article or I hear a podcast where people talk about Session Zero. You might be familiar with the concept. It's where people come together before actually playing an RPG and they invest time in talking about expectations. What's the campaign going to be about? How's it going to go? That kind of stuff. I don't have a problem with reasonable pre-game discussion and expectation management. So I don't want anybody to walk away from the segment thinking, Eric says, don't talk to your players about what's coming or what do you expect out of the campaign. I'm not saying that at all. You should absolutely talk to your players about boundaries of the campaign, right? Whether they're in-game boundaries, like character types that are acceptable, the nature of the setting, the genre, stuff like that, power levels. Or it's out-of-game stuff, like expectation attendances, how's XP going to work, all these things. You should absolutely talk about those things. My issue comes when we talk about the Session Zero like it's some sort of mystical thing. We place confidence in it that it will fix the problems that we've had in the past. And that's going to set us up for failure. If we're talking about the Session Zero as a thing that frames the entire campaign, I have a problem with it. When you sit down with several other players and you sort of frame out the way a campaign's supposed to work and you talk about, hey, this is the narrative we're going to talk about or the narrative we're going to play out from beginning to end and here's the rise and the fall and here are the important PCs and then here are the important NPCs and this is our expectation, I feel like much of the time you're going to end up putting unnecessary boundaries on your campaign. When you sit down at the table to talk about what the campaign's going to be like, you should not be writing a TV show Bible, okay? And I think sometimes, especially with some kinds of games, people really get into this narrative framing aspect and they're into the meta play of it rather than the actual play. So that's an issue. The second issue I have with it, or at least the fetishization of the Session Zero, is that it's not going to fix all your problems. If you have campaigns in the past that crapped out for one reason or another, don't think for one instant that because you called a Session Zero and got everybody together to talk about things, that your problems are fixed. They're not fixed. Campaign management, table management, they require constant effort, just like any relationship. I mean, when you sit down with five or six other people at a table and commit to getting together every 2 weeks for the rest of your lives, or whatever, that's a pretty complex relationship, and you need to be open and adult about that communication. You can't front load all that communication into one session and expect everything to be great. It requires constant effort. So please be aware of that. You're not going to, you know, you need to, if there are things that killed your previous campaigns, you need to look at what those things were. Don't think that because you heard about Session Zero on a podcast that your next campaign is going to be great just because you had a Session Zero. The third thing that gets me about a Session Zero and is I hear people talk about, yeah, we got together on Sunday and we had our Session Zero. It was like 7 hours. We created the world and the narrative and we made our characters and then we went home. I can't wait to play. That sounds terrible. I mean, if you want to get together and have a world building session and talk about it, that's great. You know, you want to play Microscope, whatever, great. I beg you, the first time your players get together, please invest some time in actually playing the freaking game. If you want to spend the first half doing the world building and talking about narrative expectations and building your characters together, great. Save some time at the end of that session to actually play. Don't do it all around the table with solo origin stories or like tear-jerking flashbacks that tell us how the heroes got to where they are now and then next week everyone will actually meet. Good Lord, don't do that. Make sure that by the end of your first session, even if you're going to call it a session zero or a session negative one or whatever else is fashionable. By the end of that first session, all your PCs need to have met each other and they need to be in the same place and they need to give a shit about what they're supposed to be doing together. And parallel to that, the players need to be excited to come back to the next session to play those characters together. All right? These aren't five or six parallel stories that you're trying to tell via advanced narrative flashback techniques. It's a role-playing game. You're playing together. So, if you spend the first 8 hours world-building and building your characters, and then you don't actually play for 2 weeks, I mean, I don't hear people talking about, oh yeah, we had the session zero, and then the campaign fizzled, and we never actually played. I mean, maybe that happens. I don't know. They probably wouldn't crow about it if it did, because that would make it sound like the session zero maybe wasn't such a great idea. If you're getting together to play a game, play the game. All right? Don't go to football camp and then the first day just do stretches, because everybody's going to complain. We spent the entire day doing stretches. What the hell? You have to reward people for what they're there for, and then get them involved. People are showing up to play the game. Okay, so session zero. I know it sounds like I'm tearing it down. If a session zero is something, is a format that sounds good to you, go for it. Tell your people that you're going to start the campaign and you're going to have a session. You're going to build characters all together, right? And oftentimes that's easier, especially, you know, we used to do that all the time because we didn't have enough books, right? The idea that we would all build our characters separately using online hoochie whatsits and then we would show up to play, that was not a thing. Like the seven of us had to show up and use the two books in Steve's basement. That's the way it worked. But anyway, yeah, get the people together, talk about things, bounce character ideas off one another, all this kind of stuff. Do that. But for the love of God, save time to actually play the game. That's why we're here. Well, if I'm recording in the commute on the way home and I sound sick, then obviously it must be an Anchorcast day. I hope my voice holds up for this segment. If not, I'll have to do it a couple times. It's getting a little scratchy. We've been sick around the house lately, and I kind of feel like I sound like a Frank Miller drawing looks, which is kind of badass, but not conducive to actual talking. So today I want to talk about con games, by which I don't mean bait and switch on your players, I mean convention sessions, where you're looking at a limited time frame playing with strangers, which sounds like more dangerous and enticing than it actually is. Con games are not your regular game. It's important that you understand that whether you're a player or a first-time con GM. I've run lots of con games, I've played lots of con games. Some of them were good, some of them were just buckets of ass, and everything in between. And so I hope that, you know, moving forward, as I talk about some of the things I've learned, or the things maybe you ought not do, that no one takes anything personally. If you've made these mistakes yourself, I've made them too, sometimes multiple times before they finally sunk in. So the first issue with con games that you need to be aware of if you're running a con game is this is not your regular game. Okay, you have, you're playing with people you don't normally play with, who may not be familiar with the rules, probably aren't familiar with whatever setting or house rule stuff you do, and you're doing it within a particular time frame. Now, there are people who can manage to pull off, hey, this is a con version of my home game. Those people manage to do it, that's great. If you are a first-time con-running DM, please do not attempt this. I want you to go into the con understanding that you are providing a nugget of goodness 4 hours or 3 hours, 3 hours and change, 5 hours, whatever, of amazing content that you are sure you can pull off with a table full of strangers, whether you get your maximum number of people or whether you get your minimum number of people. You need to be flexible enough. Wow, my voice is cracking like on the Brady Bunch. That's awesome. You need to be flexible enough to accommodate both of those occurrences because it'll happen. You'll have games that fill up or overfill. You'll have games where almost nobody shows up. And when you move into this, you need to have an understanding of what your parameters are. You need to say to yourself, all right, I advertised for six. I'll run for eight. I'll be ready to run for eight. Or I advertised for six. I'll run for three, but if it's only two, then I'll cut bait at quarter after and let those people go, right? Or whatever. Some people are fine being gung-ho and saying, screw it, I'll run for 10, I'll run for 1. Other times you will have set up your con session in such a way that you can't do it. You can't be all that flexible. So, your con game is not your regular game. The second thing is, and this is maybe the most important thing, is pre-gens. You must have pre-gens.
You need to have them available. Unless you're playing a system that allows you to generate a character, and I mean a complete character, in 5 minutes or less, it's got to be pre-gens. Because you want people to be able to hit the table running. And those pre-gens have to be fully genned. Okay? Don't bring people to your table, let them screw around for 10 minutes, point to a bucket of bicycle parts and tell them to get ready to race. You need to have those bicycles up on top of the hill pointing downward. From the moment you say go, the game has to be on. Because you're going to lose 15 minutes or 20 minutes at the beginning of the session, unless you're a real table commander, with people straggling in or figuring out what they're doing on, or hang on, I got to go get a drink, whatever. People get lost, they show up late, be ready for that. Your pre-gens need to be tuned to the game you're going to run. They need to either be part and parcel of the adventure session you're running, like they are invested, they have character traits and drives that are on their sheets that people can run with, or they need to be tropetastic examples of the kind of adventure you're running, so that people can easily pick them up and run with them. Players are naturally independent. The people that want to change things on their sheet or change their character's motivation are going to do that whether you ask them to or not. What you can't do is give them the crippleware of an incomplete sheet. Okay? Make sure that whatever system you're running, especially if it's more complex, the sheet has to be done. Everything has to be calculated out for them. Don't make them do the math. Don't make them buy equipment. If you want to say to them, hey, you have the equipment on your sheet, if there's one or two mundane things you want to add that you think I've overlooked, feel free to write them down. Good, do that. Don't let them buy equipment from the list in the book. You're going to lose 20 minutes at best. If you're going to give them pre-selected equipment lists to choose from, explorer packs or whatever, I strongly suggest you print those out as handouts. Say, here are the three or four packs you can choose from. Grab one. Let them grab one. Don't let them waste their time and yours transcribing 50 feet of hemp and rope from your sheet onto their character sheet. Do that work for them. Okay? You need to do everything you can to get that game running on time. And the reason you want to start early and start strong is because your time is limited and your time is valuable. So it comes down to pacing. If you have a 4-hour con slot, go into it understanding you're going to lose 15 or 20 minutes at the top and probably 10 minutes in the middle for a bio break. Okay? So right there, you're gone half an hour. Your 4-hour game just became a 3.5-hour game. So if you're playing a 4-hour game, don't plot out 4 hours worth of content. You're going to plot out 3.25 hours worth of content and then maybe another 30 minutes of flex content. What do I mean by that? If you're going to pace your adventure, you're not setting up a railroad. Some people hear pacing and they think that means linear. That's not what I'm trying to say. It's very easy to go through and tell yourself, here's how the adventure's going to run, and this segment will take this long, and this segment will take this long, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do that, A, B, C, D. I think that's a mistake. Every time you set up an adventure, particularly a con adventure, to be that linear, first, your players are going to see the rails. And while con players are forgiving of a certain amount of rails, I think it's far more impressive to at least obscure the rails or get rid of them entirely. And the second thing is, if you tell yourself this segment should take 15 minutes, well, what happens if it doesn't? I'd rather you be prepared for what happens if it runs short or what happens if it runs long than invest the time figuring out exactly what 15 minutes of content is. Pacing means being ready to cut stuff, knowing what can be cut. Pacing means being ready to add stuff and knowing where to add it to do the padding. Because you can't do all your padding at the beginning and you can't do all your padding at the end. You have to be able to put little pads in between, like your spine. You have little discs between your spine that make it all work. So rather than linear, where you're going to have one beginning, two middle segments, and an end or whatever, you need to have one beginning, multiple middle potential parts, right, that can happen possibly in multiple orders, and then you need to be ready for multiple endings. You need to have the win ending, you need to have the fail ending, and be ready for stuff in between. You have to be ready to improvise. People show up to a con game expecting to take this roller coaster ride through an experience, right? And that implies rails. But they also want to feel that the ups and downs are real, and that the choices they make at the table matter. right? They're not coming to a convention to have you tell them a story. They're coming to play a game. So when you make preparatory choices that take options away from the players, you need to make sure you're doing it for a good reason and that you're not doing it that often. So prepare to pace yourself. Be ready to improvise. Be ready to bring people back on track. And if you're willing to do so, be ready to go completely off track. I've been in plenty of con games that halfway through turned into absolute craziness and had nothing to do with what the original session was supposed to be about, but they ended up being better because it was a tighter session. Everybody was firing on all their cylinders. We had a great time. Now, by way of example, if those are my big principles, right? Be aware it's not your home campaign. Do pre-gens mindfully and be ready for constant looking at pacing as you start and as you go forward. Then I need to use by example some rough con games I've been in, good con games I've been in, games I've run, stuff like that. So I have two similar parallel examples of bad con games I've been in, and they were 20 years apart. So in probably 1993, I went to Balticon. This is when I was in college. Balticon is a science fiction convention, mostly literary sci-fi convention. At the time, there was sort of a burgeoning anime scene. This is pretty early, actually, for the anime scene in this region. But anyway, so we go to this con, and we're like, oh, there's the RPG room. Sweet, let's go over there. So my buddy Dave and I go, and we're looking for some D&D or something familiar, Star Wars, whatever. This is the early heyday. We probably would have even played Vampire if it was available. So this guy calls us over and recruits us to sit down and play at his table. So the two of us sit down, and we're looking at his game, and it was his game, right? So this is this guy's Heartbreaker. 1993, this thing is printed out. It's easily 200 pages, printed out on his dot matrix printer. You can imagine. Thankfully, it was not still folded. He had it in, you know, with binder clips or whatever. So he's got one copy of this game that he brought with him that he wants to play test or whatever, and he's inviting people to play. So, like a couple of fools, Dave and I sit down. And I say like a couple of fools because we're about to be in for some serious pain. And we were too nice or too dumb to get up and leave. And let me pre-admonish you on this. If you sit down at a con game and you know early on it's going to be bad, get out. I know you want to seem nice, and I know you want to be courteous. You can be nice and courteous and still leave. 4 hours is a long time to be in pain. And your time is more valuable than that. You're better off wandering to the other side of the room and getting in a two-hour pickup game with people that aren't causing you pain. So please, please do that. So we sit down to play this guy's Heartbreaker. And I don't remember what it was called, but you can imagine. It was a combination of two nouns as one word, right? Iron Forge, Soul Mace, Cosmic, I don't know what it was. So we're trying to play this game. And he says, all right, first let me show you how to make a character. That's red flag number one. Dude had no pre-gens, right? We know now, after years of experience, that if you're going to play test somebody's new game, they need to have pre-gens there. Pre-gens that show not only the setting, but the genre assumptions and the mechanics of the game that teach you. Ideally laminated, right? So we sit down to make our characters, and because we don't want to waste a lot of time, Dave and I both make dwarves, right? That way we can keep the same page of the one copy of the rules open while we're making our characters. This takes about 20 minutes. And we were trying to go fast, we really were. But he had to stop to explain things and then keep flipping around to different sections because stuff wasn't in the order you'd think it would be for character creation. All these lessons that you would think we would have learned by the early 90s and yet hadn't. And that game got worse because as soon as Dave and I thought we were ready to play, a third player sat down. He was 9. Now, I don't have a problem playing with children. I play with children all the time. I play with my own kids. I play with other people's kids. I'll rephrase that. I play role-playing games with young people all the time. Okay, but this kid was obnoxious. He was not accompanied by a parent. He was a hyperactive caricature of a snot nose. I mean, like he had like so much pixie stick dust on the corners of his mouth. He looked like an early version of the Heath Ledger Joker, right? And this kid's like, I want to play. I want to be an elf. So of course, pixie stick needs to play an elf, and it's a whole different section of the rules. So we lost another 15 minutes there. Anyway, that game was awful. I can't tell you what happened in that game. Other than Dave and I stayed to the end and were really mad at ourselves. It was one of those situations where, as we're leaving, we're looking at each other like, well, I thought you wanted to stay. Well, I thought you wanted to stay. Well, shit. I guess we should have communicated better. And from there on out, I think we had a high sign. So that was bad. You would think that I would have learned my lesson. But 20-odd years later, there I am at Gen Con, and I sign up for a game using a non-D&D, old-school, you know, vintage system. I thought, okay, I'm not doing anything this slot. Maybe I'll learn this system. It was Dragon Quest. So I sit down at the table, and there's a couple problems, red flags immediately, that, like a fool, I ignored. First, he had no pre-gens. He wanted us to make characters at the table. Two, he was running a published adventure, which is fine, but at no point did he make overtures to the idea that he was running a selection from it. He intended to start from the beginning, and that was a problem later. So there's like six of us sitting down at the table, and it rapidly becomes apparent as we're creating our characters, which took forever, that two of us have never played the game before, and we're looking to sample it, because we're OSR types and we want to try this game, right? The other four people who sit down at the game play the game regularly at home. Now, these are like hardcore vintage dudes who love Dragon Quest and know about Chris and Fords. So they sit down, they start ginning up characters. Now, you would think that their skill and experience with the game would mean that they would create characters quickly. Oh, nay. They took forever. They took longer than me and the other new guy because they asked what some people would term good questions, right? The other new guy and I asked dumb questions like, with this stat, can I use a spear, right? These other guys, the hardcore Dragon Quest grogs, they knew to ask things like, well, if I'm a half-mage, slapdash, fatback, psychic, razorback, does that mean I get 30 points of whoop-de-doo? I mean, these are questions that only hardcore people would be able to ask, let alone answer. So that took forever. It was almost 2 hours making characters. I wish I were kidding. We spent half the session making characters. Then the adventure began, by which I mean the adventure began. Page one, right? This is like a 30-page old-school adventure. And it starts with like a page and a half of box text about this quest we're all going to go on. And do we accept the quest? And will we do what the king asks? F it, dude. Start after that. Start with, the king has sent you. Right? Think about Ghost Tower of Inverness and other tournament adventures that say, you are at the place because you must be. Never play through that prelim stuff at a con game. Oh my god. So because we start at the beginning, we accept the quest from the king, and he says, very good. Here is your allowance for provisions. I'm sorry, what? Your allowance for provisions. So then we spend the next hour, I wish I were lying, we spend the next hour, hour three of this Dragon Quest game, spending money on provisions, food, rope, mules, carts. Well, who has the cart driving skill? I do. You don't. Let's figure this out. How many mules can we get? Well, let's upgrade the mules to ponies. Well, no way. Mules, blah, blah, blah. Two of the grogs have a 10-minute conversation about the optimal setup for a multi-mule cart. I swear to God, the multi-mule cart argument. So, finally, this is all done. I wish I were dead. I wish I were dead. I want to leave. I want to go back to my hotel room and drink expensive minibar bullshit. But I didn't. I stayed. I'm like, okay, there's only an hour left. And the other new guy and I, who did not know each other and probably should have commiserated afterward, are exchanging looks across the table like, oh my god, can we throw Mama from the train each other? Is that allowed? Finally, the fourth hour was the first combat. We get our multi-mule team out on the road, and we're attacked by, I don't know, hobgoblins or something. So we spend this hour dealing with the hex map, because it's got battle hexes rather than a grid, and learning the combat, and it took an hour for the six of us to defend our mule train from these dozen hobgoblins or whatever. And it's so bad, like, towards the end of it, I'm just charging. I'm like leaping my dude into ravines trying to hack at hobgoblins because I want my character to die. Like, not in a way that I'm trying to be disruptive, but we've got 20 minutes left, right? So screw it. It's a con game. You see the same thing at the end of a DCC con game where everybody's trying to blow all their luck and spell burn all their stats because who cares? It's a con game, right? Well, in this case, I wanted my little dwarf guy or whoever he was, I don't even remember, I wanted him dead because then I could excuse myself from the table with honor. As it turned out, that's 4 hours of my life I'll never get back. Please don't do that. That's why I'm so adamant about pre-gens. The other thing is scope. I should have mentioned this earlier. The scope of the adventure. This isn't your home game, where you can have, you know, 200 hours of content sort of figured out in your brain, and then sit down and we play four of it. It doesn't work that way. I want your best 4 hours of content. If you're going to play a published adventure, unless it's meant for a four-hour run, or can be trimmed to that, you can't play the whole thing. You're going to have to pick representative sections. And nobody playing a con game is going to mind, right? If you say, we're starting here, we're going to do this bit, all right, we're going to pause, we're going to go on pee break, and when we come back, we'll jump ahead a week, and you're at this other place. No one cares. It's totally fine. Everybody would rather you do that than spend an hour outfitting your mule train. I have had some good con games. I've played in a number of good con games where people were engaged. That's what it takes. You want the GM to be engaged. You want the majority of the players to be engaged in an infectious way so that everybody's contributing positive energy to the table. If you get one or two lumps at the table, you're going to have a hard time. Doubly so if one of those lumps is the GM. But that happens. So, just to close up, let me talk about some of my con games that I thought were semi-successful and why I thought they might be semi-successful. One con game I'm thinking of that I ran at North Texas, man, talk about adversity. My life is so hard. So I had six people signed up. This was for a Sunday slot, which I thought was pretty boss. I had six people signed up for a Sunday. Get to run the game, three people show up. I had lost four and added one, so we had three people. They each played two of the pre-gens. These were complete pre-gens. They didn't need to add anything to the sheet except names. And we had a pretty good time. I had kind of hoped we'd get more people involved as the game went on. I was ready. You know, I briefed all my players and said, look, if more people show up, be ready to shed your second favorite PC, right, so more people can play, and everybody was down with that, right? I thought we'd get more people because, you know, the table was covered with plastic dinosaurs. But that's the sort of thing that attracts walk-by attention, but not necessarily sit-down attention, I guess. I don't know. Maybe it's because it was Sunday morning. Sunday morning slots are hard. I thought that was a pretty good game because everybody was engaged. So I was pleased with that one. Other games I was pleased with, I like to try and do a gimmick to make a game memorable so that even if, and this is a total cheat, right? Even if people didn't love the game, even if the game itself was B-, they remember something positive walking away. And maybe that's easier for me because I tend to run kind of light games, humorous games. So I ran one game at Trident Con where everybody was a dwarf. This was a DCC game. Everybody was dwarves. And we did two things to make that light. One was that because they were all dwarven prisoners, they were in a dwarven prison, I had a deck of index cards with their crime. And everybody pulled one. And they had to sort of say, this is my crime, and here's what happened. Like, they told the real story, right? I'm innocent. Or, you know, how they came about to be arrested for that thing. That was pretty cool. Because it got personality traits out, and everybody was able to be kind of silly within the first 10 minutes of the game, and that broke the ice. I strongly recommend index cards. If you're going to hand out random magic items to people, like if you say, hey, everybody's going to be this level and get a random magic item, I'd suggest you do it with index cards, because then you can actually control what you're handing out. If you're going to do it with a random table, do it from a random table you have created, okay? Because that way you're not looking at a table in a book and saying, ooh, I didn't like that result, or we already have one of those in the party, or, you know, that's an okay item, but it's not really going to be super useful in this game. Like, I understand the temptation to do that, but you're wasting time. Go ahead and do it on index cards, let everybody pick. That way there's no duplicates unless you want there to be duplicates. And everybody can have the thing right there. They don't even have to write it down. You can put the description on the other side, whatever you want to do. Or if they trade them back and forth, they can just hand the item cards around. There's something nice about the tactile nature of handing an item card to somebody. That may be the only positive thing I learned from LARP. Anyway, that session was good because of those and because of the beards. Because everybody was playing dwarves and we wanted to be silly, I brought a bunch of craft foam and scissors and string and stuff and glue. And I gave everybody the supplies and the instructions on how to make their own beards. So during the first half hour, as we were doing introductions and some of the expository stuff, everybody made beards. And then we sat them on the nearby table to dry. And by the time we had finished the game, the beards were dry, and we could all put on our dwarf beards and take a big picture. I thought that was pretty cool, because then everybody's walking away with two things. One, the knowledge that they did this silly shit at a con, And two, they've got their beard. So they're walking around the rest of the day, and if people say, what the heck are you carrying? Then they get to say, well, this is my beard. I just played in this old dwarf game, blah, blah, blah. So there, we're building memories, right? We're trying to get crap into people's hands to get them to talk about your game. Not just in a marketing way, but we want them to have a souvenir to help them remember a good time. That's why some con GMs give out pencils or dice or whatever, right? Or prizes. Another decent con game I ran that didn't work the way I wanted it to, gimmick-wise, was at a game day called Legacies in Philly that was run by the Stormlord guys. I was running Marvel Superheroes, and I had a Saturday morning slot. So thinking about this, I thought, man, superheroes, Saturday morning cartoons. I mean, I'm of an age where Saturday morning cartoons have some meaning to me, right? So I thought, okay, let's lean into this. And so we did the Marvel Superheroes game as though it were an episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, right? We had the theme song. We used those sort of, you know, in-genre assumptions, those characters or whatever. And I brought a bunch of sugary cereal with bowls and spoons and milk so we could all sit around and eat the crappy cereal we weren't allowed to eat when we were kids while we're doing Saturday morning cartoons. I thought this was brilliant. I was wrong. You see, people tend to roll into a con having already eaten, or they bring their food with them. No one rolled in Saturday morning expecting to eat with me at their morning session. So everybody kind of demurred, and they're all sitting around, we're playing, and I'm like trying to encourage people, I'm pouring a bowl of cereal or whatever as we're half an hour in. And it turned out, instead of being a bunch of people laughing around a table playing superheroes and eating sugary cereal, it was a bunch of people laughing around a table playing superheroes, and one weird dude, that'd be me, eating cereal. I don't know what that looked like to passersby. Like, dude, that guy's eating cereal. Okay, whatever. So sometimes a gimmick is brilliant in concept, maybe, but suffers in execution. But I guarantee that those people remembered that game, right? Not only was there the dumb cereal stuff and the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends stuff, but I was running Ghost Tower of Inverness with Marvel Superheroes, which is something worth talking about anyway. I knew that would get talked about even if I failed, right? Because it's either going to be, oh, this was this fun game that I played, or, man, I can't believe that guy tried that. Either way, you know, there's no such thing as bad press. All right, so I haven't run any con games in a little while because I've taken some time off from Trident Con, but I hope to in the future. I like the constraints of the format. You learn things by putting those constraints on you, the same way you would as a writer, having constraints and parameters that bind you. The time slot is hard. The strangers is difficult. But it's totally worth it. The other piece of advice I would give, and I think that other people who run a lot of con games might support this, is that if you run the same thing multiple times, it's actually worth it. I'm not saying you need to do it every time, but if you run the same session, essentially, a couple times, it's not going to go the same twice. You will have minor variances, you will have major variances, and you will learn things, not just about the adventure, but you'll learn things about your own DM style, and you'll learn things about the way players work, because different groups of players are not going to do things the same way. When I went to UConn a couple years ago, I ran a bunch of D&D Adventurers League first-level stuff, which was great because it was some experienced people, but a lot of newbies, right? I had some kids playing some sessions, stuff like that. And I ran the same, like, two or three adventures, like, two or three times each of them. They were pretty different. But what's interesting is that you find that your confidence builds. The things you feel you can get away with. You know what you can cut. You know what you should add. And you know when you have space to do silly voices and more NPC interaction, or when you should hustle and get to the next encounter. So, like with any other aspect of this game mastering thing that we do, look for mastery. Repetition breeds mastery. Don't do too much, because it can also breed boredom. But if you want to get good at running con games, you got to get in there and do it. It's a completely different, well, not completely different, it's a very different kind of GMing that maybe requires, if not different skills than your home game, it requires a different mix of those same skills. And I strongly encourage you to give it a shot. You don't know what you can do until you're put under pressure, the time constraint, and see what you can actually come up with as a con game. Best of luck. As I record this, it's the day before American Thanksgiving, and I'm hoping to have this episode out this weekend. We'll see what happens. But, you know, getting ready for Thanksgiving and running to the store multiple times and getting everything together and all the cooking with family, has kind of put me in mind of a metaphor for the way we run a successful role-playing campaign, and that's as a potluck. Think back, maybe your family holiday meals were like this, or you experienced them through a spouse or a friend. Think of the idea of a family where when the holiday meal rolls around, one person is doing all the work. You know, I guess typically that would be mom, right? Is slaving away in the kitchen for days before the event and the entire day of the event. And then there's the event and everybody shows up and they eat. And then maybe the same person is doing the dishes after. I think we've all maybe experienced role-playing campaigns that were like that, where the DM was the one doing 97% of the work. They were not only preparing the material and running the game and ensuring that the game stayed on track, but also dealing with the aftermath stuff, scheduling the game, making sure everybody showed up, making sure everybody had their pencils and dice. And if they hosted, maybe they were the ones providing the food, too. That's less than ideal. In a better situation, you'd have it more like a potluck, right? Where everybody's bringing something to the table, quite literally, whether it's food, or they're taking a turn hosting, or they're making sure that they're contributing in, you know, the in-between game email thread. Everybody needs to be contributing in some way, not only during the game, but in between to keep it moving forward. I think it's fair to say that most of the campaigns that I've played in or run that either fizzled out or lasted longer than they were satisfying were campaigns where not everybody was contributing, or the contributions were so disproportional that the bulk of the burden, as it were, is on the DM. That's going to contribute to DM burnout, and parallel to that, you end up with a table full of players who aren't particularly invested. And we've all seen this with players who just expect to kind of show up every other week and be entertained for 4 to 8 hours and then not think about it again until the next session. You know, they don't level up their people, they don't think about where they want to go next on the map, they're not planning or whatever. And this stands in stark contrast to the sort of campaign where it's in high engagement mode and you know that everybody's having a great time because they're bugging you in between sessions all the time. They're asking you questions. Somebody shows up with a hypothetical castle design. You know, all this kind of stuff, right? You know, maybe we've all played in campaigns where you get to a certain level, maybe mid-level, and the PCs have taken over some place as their hideout, right? And then they want to invest a lot of time in setting traps and exploring the place or whatever, and making it theirs. And that has kind of overlapped with the best high engagement part of the campaign, right? It's the low mid levels, right? Everybody's invested. They know what to expect. They're part of the parcel of the storyline. They feel like the world's alive. There's got to be a way to get that level of engagement throughout, not only from session one or session zero, if you're into that, all the way to session 200. That's a high bar, I think, to expect that level of engagement. It's going to come and go. But if you have a sufficiently engaged group, then the burden of keeping the fires burning can shift between players. You might have one stage where, you know, three of your six players are, like, super engaged, and then one of them is less engaged because he's got stuff going on at home or whatever, but somebody else steps up. That's what I mean by engagement. I don't mean that the work has to be equal all the time. Everybody should be taking turns. But that's kind of what the potluck is, right? Some people bring stuff that is good for the beginning of the campaign. The appetizers, right? These are the people who join the game and they make sure, hey, that first session was awesome. Thanks for running it. When are we playing next? And they're going to hound you and hound the other players to make sure that the second session, the third session happen, right? Because you got to get 5 or 6 sessions in before this stuff really locks in. Otherwise, it's going to fizzle out. And then you have people that are good for the entree, and then you have people that are good for the dessert, right? You get to the point in a campaign where, you know, maybe interest starts to wane among some of your table population, but you have a couple people that are super engaged with the idea of doing that high-level play or the end game or, by God, we've got to finish this storyline, that lich is still out there type thing. And they will help you coast to the end of a successful campaign. So it's a potluck. In order to throw a successful potluck in campaigning as in dinner, you have to tell people it's a potluck, right? It has to be on the invitation. And what I mean by that is you can't say, hey, I'm running a game, this is what it's about, show up. And expect people to show up super engaged. We hear a lot from your standard advice givers about reaching out to your players and figuring out what they want in the game, and that's all true. But you also have to have open communications like a freaking adult about satisfaction levels. Are we playing often enough? Are we playing too often? What should we be doing in between games to keep everybody excited? You know, I've had campaigns where the players are great while we're there. You know, it's Sunday afternoon, they're ready to play, we have 6 or 8 awesome hours, and then for another 2 weeks, or God help us, for the 4 weeks in between sessions, it's crickets. And people show back up again, they're engaged, but I kind of feel like stringing this stuff together makes it into an ongoing campaign, rather than just a thing that we sometimes show up and do. Now, maybe, as a person who DMs a lot more than he plays, maybe I'm investing too much emotionally in this idea of a campaign that is successful, right? Lots of people, especially people that mostly play, are completely content with a lifetime of one-shots. You know, not to get too metaphorical, but I prefer the monogamy, the boring monogamy of a long campaign. I think that's what the game is designed for, particularly with D&D. And I think that's where the game shines. So, again, thinking about Thanksgiving, you know, if we want to be thankful for the great campaigns we've had in the past and the ones we hope to have in the future, maybe think about this potluck concept. And if that metaphor is something that you think will resonate with your players, go ahead and use it. Talk to them about, hey, I want everybody to bring something to the table, and I mean that literally.